From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Right after the news, we'll listen to my conversation with University of Iowa ER Dr. Christopher Burrish. He just returned from Haiti a few days before the earthquake, and now Dr. Burrish is putting together a team to return. Then, science writer Ethan Waters. In his new book, Crazy Like Us, Waters makes the case that the U.S. is actually changing the symptoms and prevalence of mental illness around the world. And because of the news out of Haiti, my conversation with former Des Moines Register reporter Andrew Bleckman, originally scheduled for today, will be heard at a later date. Iowa ER physician Chris Burrish, on his return to Haiti, follows this news. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today. I'm Ben Kiefer. Aid workers are focusing on the overwhelming challenge of getting food and water to millions of earthquake survivors in Haiti. Meanwhile, government workers are burying thousands of bodies in mass graves. UN peacekeepers say people are growing increasingly desperate and impatient for help. The Brazilian military is warning aid convoys to add security to guard against looting. The Red Cross estimates up to 50,000 people were killed in Tuesday's massive earthquake. A University of Iowa doctor just returned from Haiti. Now he's trying to get back to the country to help with relief efforts. Dr. Christopher Burrish has been traveling to Haiti for the past 7 years. He says even before the disaster, conditions there were reminiscent of a disaster zone. Dr. Burrish hopes to join an organized medical team leaving next Tuesday to provide relief efforts to Haiti. I spoke with Dr. Burrish yesterday. He said he had just returned from Haiti less than 1 week ago.
We were down there doing medical work. We've been going down for about 7 years now, maybe eight. And we've started going back a little bit more often in an attempt to try and treat some chronic conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes. And so this is actually our second trip in the last 6 months. And
so medical work. This is at a clinic.
Well, what we do is we stay in a guest house in Layagon, which is a city of about 200,000 people, about 20 miles west of Port-au-Prince, 10 miles west of the epicenter. And so we stay there, and then we usually go out into the community. We drive kind of up into the mountains as far as we can go, and then we usually rent donkeys and hike for a few hours to some of these places. So they're kind of, you know, we kind of want to try and reach some remote communities that don't have much of a shot at medical care otherwise.
So, Dr. Burrish, you're back just a few days, and then you hear of the massive earthquake on Haiti on Tuesday. How did you hear about it?
Somebody sent me a page. Somebody from work sent me a page. I was just getting home.
And, so you were paged, and then you found out about it. And as we all did through looking at the horrendous images and hearing the reporting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, and much like I think you guys, I've been getting most of my information actually through email and Facebook and other kind of the social media, which has been really fantastic, actually, to be able to connect with people at all. I, you know, have a Haitian cell phone, and those things have been out now since the earthquake.
So your social media allows you to connect with people on Haiti?
Yeah, we have some friends in and around Port-au-Prince that we're able to get in contact with, and they've been blogging and Twittering and, you know, all the things that people do. We've not had any contact until just about half an hour ago from anyone from Layagon, which has had me really worried. But it sounds like we're starting to get some messages from there.
So just a half an hour ago, you got some messages from the area where you'd been working, and what's going on there? This is a remote area.
Well, you know, it turns out Legon's not actually that remote. It's right on the coast, and it's, you know, it's only 20 miles from Port-au-Prince, and it's not very far at all. But it's made remote by the fact that, you know, the epicenter of the earthquake was right in between those two towns, and so there's really no way to travel from one to the other now. So even though it's not geographically isolated, it is in fact now pretty isolated. And so the word is that the hospital we usually work at has collapsed. Luckily, there weren't too many people inside, but those that were inside are dead. The guest house that we stay at sounds like might be standing, although that's not been confirmed. There's a school of nursing there in Laogan, which is a fantastic school. We usually are able to work with some of their student nurses who are really amazing. And it sounds like that building is damaged but standing. And then there's a house built by the Gates Foundation used by Notre Dame for filariasis research, and it sounds like that is damaged but standing. And both the staff and students of the nursing school and the staff of the filariasis house are okay. And so that's been a huge relief. It sounds like otherwise it's kind of pandemonium. There's no relief there at all yet. They're out of medicines and they're out of supplies and they're running out of food. And it sounds a little bit desperate, actually.
Are there still question marks? Are there still people you know you worked with there that you haven't heard from?
Yeah, a lot of people. We just found out actually this email, which is a huge relief, that our friends John and Susie Parker, who have been volunteering down there, are supposed to be alive. So that's great, but we haven't heard about any of our Haitian friends down there yet, who live very, very close to the hospital that collapsed. So I'm nervous about them. And I know that the people that worked at the hospital that have become good friends over the years, we've not heard anything from them either. So we're still very hopeful, but of course very worried.
Dr. Burish, of course, the reason that you've been going to Haiti is that Haitians face ominous health challenges anyway. What does the picture look like for the survivors now in terms of the health?
Well, I got to tell you, it's not good. You know, I think there's going to be kind of challenges upon challenges for the Haitians that live down there. I think there's this first sort of wave of deaths is, there's people that had bricks fall on them and buildings fall on them, and there's not much that can be done to help those people, I don't think, at this point. There's people who have been injured by falling debris, but maybe not mortally. They're very probably going to develop wound infections over the next few days that are going to need to be addressed soon. I think there wasn't a great infrastructure before, but now there's going to be not any power, no really clean water. There's been teams down there working on providing wells, and I think they've built or restored something like 50 to 100 wells in the last few years, and I'm worried that those are now compromised.
I understand.
So the lack of clean water is going to really take a toll. In terms of diarrheal illness and other problems.
Sounds like this is taking a bit of an emotional toll on you as a doctor. You know these people.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be. I don't mean to sound so caught up in it. It's just difficult having just been there, and you don't very often get to reconnect with these folks. I mean, it's kind of like a family reunion when you go down there each year, And you just have to admire the folks that live down there. I mean, they're just so tough, and they do so much with so little, and they're so giving even when they don't have much to give. And so to think about them suffering is, it's hard. It's really hard. And, I bleed for those guys, and so I'm anxious to get back down there because it's. I mean, I guess I do have mixed feelings about going down, without being part of a huge relief effort, without being part of the military or the Red Cross, because I don't want to get in the way, and I don't want to. I think it's dangerous to have untrained people kind of running around with IV poles and Band-Aids, but. But you know, on the other hand, if I didn't go, I wouldn't be able to sleep. I mean, I guess I can't sleep anyway, but I wouldn't be able to sleep in the future if I didn't at least try to do something. And we've got, you know, my team is, we've got a great team. We have, you know, some of the best people I've ever worked with that were just down there. And to a person, they say, you know, we've got our bags still packed. We're ready to go.
I understand this conversation interrupts you in the midst of gathering provisions. What are you gathering for this trip?
Well, we're not sure exactly how things are going to unfold, both in terms of getting there and then what's going to happen once we get down there. My supposition is that there's going to be very little in the way of fuel or transportation, and so we're trying to make sure that we can carry everything that we need for the next week to 10 days. So I'm focused on water purification things and food, as well as kind of lightweight medical supplies. We do have some water purifiers that we stashed away that we were getting ready to distribute through a group called Worldwide Village. And so I'm thankful that those resources are still intact. At the guest house near the hospital, there is also kind of this industrial strength chlorine generator that I'm hoping we'll be able to get so we can help people out. So yeah, just basically stuff for food, and then we're going to be sleeping outside. I don't think any of the buildings down there are worth risking. So it's going to essentially be, you know, I guess what's the worst camping trip of my life. So we're just trying to, you know, it's hard to know what to expect. We're trying to be ready for whatever comes up.
Dr. Burrish, we're speaking on Thursday, late on Thursday. When do you hope to be back in Haiti, if everything goes well?
Tentatively, it sounds like we're hoping to land on Tuesday. We're reaching out through a number of different organizations to see what's available in terms of flights. And so if everything goes well, we'll be somewhere in Port-au-Prince or Laigon on Tuesday.
Well, we want to wish you good luck, and we hope to check in with you, get an update, Dr. Burrish, after you come back from Haiti. And we wish you well there and hope to talk to you again in happier circumstances.
All right. Thanks for your time.
My conversation yesterday with University of Iowa Dr. Christopher Burrish, who is preparing to travel to Haiti as part of an organized medical unit to help earthquake victims. Dr. Burrish's medical team is looking for the public's help in securing antibiotics to administer to earthquake victims. Next, I talk with author and journalist Ethan Waters. Waters looks at the westernization of mental illness. A handful of mental health disorders, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and anorexia among them, appear to be spreading across cultures with the speed of contagious disease. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For the remainder of the hour, my guest is science writer Ethan Waters. Waters is the author of Urban Tribes, an examination of the mores of the so-called Never Marrieds, co-author of Making Monsters as well, an indictment of the recovered memory movement. Waters is also a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Discover, Men's Journal, Wired, and Public Radio's This American Life. Waters' new book is titled Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche, published by Free Press. In it, he makes the case that American culture has not only spread around the world through Hollywood flicks and fast food, but that we are also bulldozing the human psyche itself. Ethan Waters joins us this afternoon from his home in San Francisco. Good afternoon, Ethan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to the crux of your new book, that the U.S. is actually changing the symptoms and prevalence of mental illness around the world, set the groundwork, if you could, by telling us how patients and doctors around the world have in recent decades become westernized in the way that we talk about mental disorders.
We have America and the West in general has a tremendous influence over how the world thinks about these things. The diagnostic manual that we produce by the American Psychiatric Association is the Bible around the world in terms of thinking about mental disorders. We train many of the world's top clinicians. We hold the top conferences. We have the top journals. Certainly, most of the major drug companies that export their psychopharmaceuticals around the world originate in America. We're tremendously powerful in this realm. And as you know, the thesis of the book is that as we do that, as we shape the way the West of the world thinks about these disorders and talks about them and categorizes them and treats them, that there is a cultural shaping of the disorder as well. And mental illnesses are always tied to the cultural conception of and expectations that surround them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're training the rest of the world to think like us, we're actually shaping those mental illnesses and shaping the other cultures' fundamental sense of themselves as well.
So explain what you mean by that. Go further into that. You're saying that the experience of mental illness cannot be separated from culture. When we thought that was science, right?
Well, we have this idea that we're beyond culture, but this becomes very clear, for instance, when you look across history. You can look to the Victorian era Europe and see the diagnosis of hysteria, for instance. And here we have tens of thousands of women with really phenomenal displays of mental illness. They have hysterical leg paralysis, hysterical blindness, all these very florid displays of this. And this was, looking back, this is not a matter of those women faking those symptoms. This is a matter of what the unconscious mind does when it becomes unstuck. It looks to the culture to understand how to express that mode of illness in that particular time, and it picks up cues from the culture, and it picks up cues from the mental health profession and the medical profession about how to do this. And this all happens without our intending it to happen. So you see anorexia rise in one era and go away in another area. In another part of the world, you have other expressions of mental illness. Maybe you have Koro, which is the debilitating belief that your genitals are retracting into your body and will cause death, or amok. You look across cultures and across times, you can very clearly see that mental illnesses have an interaction with culture. Your expectations about them, what you focus on as the primary symptom, and what people around you tend to look for, all those expectations tend to be self-fulfilling, and culture shapes a mental illness. That does not to say that it doesn't also have a biomedical component at its base, but beyond that, cultures shape mental illnesses, and they shape it oftentimes through the treatment of that mental illness. So treatment becomes very important in this issue, and as we teach the rest of the world to treat mental illnesses and think about them in certain ways, we're also actually shaping the very thing we're intending to treat.
Okay, let's take a concrete example, the example that we have ongoing right now, that you also have a case study that's very much like it in your book. You look at four different case studies. One of them deals with post-traumatic stress disorder, and Western trauma counselors often rush into foreign disaster zones to help survivors deal with PTSD, and that's no doubt happening in Haiti as we speak. In the book, you write about the case of Sri Lanka after the tsunami, and so help us understand how you're saying aid workers actually brought with them through culture PTSD and caused local communities there in some cases more distress than if they had not known about this disorder called PTSD.
Well, the key thing here is not that they caused the distress, but they shaped the distress in a certain way. So every human has a psychological bad reaction to a horrible traumatic event. There's no way around that. But once again, immediately culture begins to shape that notion. And what anthropologists and cross-cultural psychiatrists know is that meaning, when it comes to a psychological trauma, matters a great deal. How you conceive of the trauma, how you conceive of where the damage is done. And for instance, in Sri Lanka, the anthropologists that have studied this know that Sri Lankans don't, for the most part, conceive of the psychological trauma caused by something like the tsunami as happening in their head. They see it as a damage to their social group or their role in the social group. They feel trauma when they're unable to fulfill their social role or their social group has been disrupted. And that is how they'll describe the reaction to the tsunami. An American, when you ask him where's the damage done after that bad event that happened to you, are likely to point to their head and say, it's in my mind. My mind has become chemically imbalanced because of this event. Now, those are two distinct ways of thinking about trauma, and neither one is necessarily right or wrong. But when you start to think about how to heal from it, a Sri Lankan, you know, American would say, it would make perfect sense for Americans suffering from PTSD to say, for instance, I'm going to take time away from my job and time away from my social responsibilities to heal with an individual counselor, maybe, to heal from this this illness. For a Sri Lankan to say that, to say, I'm going to take time away from my social responsibilities to heal from this thing, suddenly there's a cultural disconnect, because fulfilling the social role for a Sri Lankan is the expression of mental health. So oftentimes this is not a matter of we're bringing PTSD, we're bringing ideas about the symptoms, and we're bringing ideas about the cure that often don't match the cultural notions of psychological trauma that already exist in the culture. And when we do that, we can cause all sorts of problems and havoc that we don't intend to.
So when you laid out those two paths of dealing with the trauma of the tsunami, do we know which path leads to more resiliency, getting you back functioning in society, which I guess would be the measure of overcoming a trauma, wouldn't it?
Well, in general, I think, you know, the case that most cross-cultural psychiatrists will make is that certainly we in America are more vulnerable to psychological trauma than people in the rest of the world. And if you think about it, this just makes perfect sense. We deal with much less trauma than the rest of the world, much less early death and violence than other places in the world. And that, you know, and that means we have less, we show less resilience. We're more likely to think of an event as causing us to be mentally ill than in other places in the world. And I'm not sure if that's because of our notion of PTSD or simply because of our good luck and good fortune in being a very wealthy nation that deals with less trauma.
So our understanding, this biomedical understanding of mental health, is giving us a thinner skin, making us less resilient?
It may be doing more than that. It may be, you know, we think of that notion as being, as reducing stigma about mental illness. We promote it around the world. We say, if you think of mental illness as like, just like any other disease, certainly all those myths you have about spirit possession or whatever it might be will go away, and the mentally ill person will become less burdened by, you know, the stigma. And in fact, that idea of biomedical mental illness, while it might be scientifically true, I certainly tend to believe it, when it goes into other cultures, it tends to have the opposite effect, which is that it tends to make people want more distance from the mentally ill person, think of them as more intractably broken and more dangerous and more unpredictable. So it has oftentimes the exact opposite effect that we intended to, even though I certainly wouldn't want to dismiss that idea. And I know that the biomedical notion of mental illness is leading and will lead to a great deal of understanding about the mind, but there's a distinction here between that scientific idea and how we apply it in science and how that idea goes out in culture and shapes people's behavior to the mentally ill. And unfortunately, we're in a little bit of a conundrum, which is that the scientific progress is certainly great, but the idea that's wrapped around that idea and goes out into culture actually oftentimes creates a great deal more stigma than was there before.
Ethan Waters, we'll have to take a short break. Science writer Ethan Waters with us, his latest book, Crazy Like Us. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk about the globalization of the American psyche. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Perhaps you have some observations about how cultural differences feed into our views of mental illness. 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number. Questions for Ethan Waters. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, case studies by Ethan Waters looking at depression in Japan, anorexia in Hong Kong. When we return, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday on this program, Janine Beck will be in my seat, and she'll give us another legislative update, as she does during the legislative session in Des Moines. Then on Tuesday, we'll look at a new study by Iowa State University anthropologist Jill Preetz that finds that savanna chimpanzees in Senegal have a near-human understanding of wildfires and actually change their behavior in anticipation of the fire's movement. This is important because the use and control of fire is thought to distinguish humans from other animals. Tuesday on The Exchange, Jill Preetz and Ben Beck of the Great Ape Trust of Iowa on this program. Today, talking with Ethan Waters, his new book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche, looks at how the U.S. is not only changing the way the world treats and understands mental illness,
but how we are actually changing the symptoms and prevalence of the diseases themselves. He's joining us live from San Francisco. Let's look at another case study that you have in your book. You have four of them in there. We spoke briefly about the PTSD case. You looked at Sri Lankans in the aftermath of the tsunami there a few years ago. In your book, you write that GlaxoSmithKline exported an American version of depression to Japan, and this in order to create a market for its drug Paxil. Tell us what you discovered there.
It's a very interesting story. Before 1990 in Japan, the Japanese did have a notion of depression, a clinical notion of depression, but it was much different from ours. It was conceived of as a much more severe disease. It was the sort of mental illness as severe as something like we think about schizophrenia, requiring hospitalization. You could not function with this thing. It was also considered to be very rare. So all through the 90s, you had, Prozac was the best-selling drug in the world, and it was not introduced in Japan because the drug companies looked at the market and they thought the Japanese are not going to take this drug because they don't have a culturally parallel notion of sadness, our form of depression as being a mental illness. And then, around the late 90s, the drug companies started to turn their attention to this, and they very, very precisely began to target. They wanted to move the line between where a notion of melancholy or sadness would be considered normal and pathological. And they actually enlisted some of the very cross-cultural researchers that know most about this, and most about how culture shapes mental illness. So this wasn't a matter of Japan having ignored depression before. This was a matter, they have just as much sadness there as we do, but simply that they put it in other cultural categories. In fact, Japan had up until the latter 90s, had a real cultural embrace of the emotion of sadness. They thought of it as almost a transcendent state in some cases. It's something that could give you moral guidance in the world, that it was actually thought of in very positive terms in a lot of ways. Then along comes the mega marketing campaign of GlaxoSmithKline in early 2000, which promoted depression as, quote-unquote, a cold of the soul. They wanted to move that line between where it was considered pathological and normal, and indeed, they managed to do that. In the first year, they had $100 million worth of sales, and now it's a hugely profitable drug. And the psychiatrists in Japan who I profile in the book who have watched this have seen a real cultural shift in how the Japanese think about depression and how they experience it now as a mental illness as opposed to the cultural narratives that they had before. Mm-hmm.
Was there no pushback from Japanese mental health experts in this American version of depression as challenging it at all?
It really caught them by surprise. Initially when the DSM came out first with the American notion of depression, Japanese psychiatrists, for the most part, dismissed it. They said that is not a mental illness here in Japan. We don't conceive of it this way. But GlaxoSmithKline did two things. One, it often enlists the mental health profession, and they're very smart about enlisting the doctors themselves. They give them a lot of money for speaking. There's this interplay there, so they get a lot of people on their side by simply providing them with a lot of money. And they did another thing, which is they fundamentally went around the mental health apparatus. They marketed these drugs directly to the people, even though there's a similar, in Japan there's a similar prohibitions against marketing a prescription drug directly. They found all sorts of ways around this. So they really did this through the popular culture, as opposed to through the mental health profession.
How did you research this particular study to make sure that this is not just sort of conspiracy theory gone wild?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the great stories that I was told in the book was by a professor at McGill named Larry Kermayer, and he's really one of the top people in the field of cross-cultural psychiatry. And he was invited by GlaxoSmithKline itself in 2000 to a conference in Kyoto, Japan, where he really witnessed what I'm talking about. He witnessed the GlaxoSmithKline executives and drug company insiders wanting to learn this knowledge, wanting to know how cultures shape mental illness. And it became very clear through that meeting that they were interested in shifting this idea in Japan. They wanted to move the line between and Americanize the Japan notion. And there's also other anthropologists of big business that have really gotten some great inside scoop on this. Anthropologist and business researcher named Kalman Applebaum got a lot of the drug company's executives at that time in 2000 to talk to him about what they were doing. And they would talk in very open terms about this idea of evolution. They would say, well, Japan is 5 years behind the United States, and China is 10 years behind the Japan. And what they were meaning was they were 5 years behind us, that everything was evolving towards our way of thinking about these things, our way of treating these things. And they felt their job was to help that evolution along. And I think if you look to their motivations, I think they would, to a person, probably believe that they were helping Japan and China recognize depression, that they were providing a medicine that helped people. But I also think at the same time, you can't ignore the tremendous amount of money that can be made when you shift a cultural conception of depression such that it fits a drug. So there were dual motivations, certainly, but the motivation of money cannot be excluded.
If you've just joined us, my guest for this part of the hour is science writer Ethan Waters. Crazy Like Us is his new book, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Perhaps you have an observation to make, a personal observation about mental health that you'd like to chip into our conversation. 1-866-780-9100 or email us theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. What has been the reaction to your book, this thesis of uniformly shaping the way we look, the way we experience mental illness around the world from those in the mental health field, from Big Pharma?
I have not yet heard the reaction from Big Pharma. In terms of getting responses, I've gotten a lot of responses from psychiatrists and psychologists. The article I wrote based on this topic in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine was the most emailed article in the newspaper all week. And I've heard a lot from psychologists. And so far, with one or two exceptions, they seem to, or at least the people that are contacting me, seem to be very encouraged by this notion. They want, they're very interested in this idea, and they seem to sort of almost instantly sort of get it, that there is the possibility for damage and that we have to be careful. We should not, I'm not arguing in the book that we should never take our ideas to another culture. We have scientific advances, and our drugs are certainly getting better over time. We should not keep those from the rest of the world. But at the same time, the thesis of the book is that we have as much to understand from the rest of the world about mental health and illness as we have to teach them. And there's no stopping globalization. There's no redrawing those cultural boundaries. And there's no cultural purity anymore. But at least we could hope that the information and understanding as it crosses cultural boundaries goes both ways.
Is this cultural aspect, this cultural component of mental illness, part of training our mental health practitioners in the United States?
I think it absolutely should be. As I might have said before, I think every generation of mental health professionals thinks that they've somehow gotten to the end of culture's influence, that now they've gotten down to the root cause. And I think we tend not to look across history and say, gee, every generation seems to, culture seems to shape mental illness to a great degree. We are not at the end of history. This is still going on. We need to understand the interplay between the cultural understanding of mental illness as it's shaped by the doctors themselves. And as it's spoken about in culture through journalists and on TV and through movies, we need to understand the interaction between that and what someone experiences unconsciously and then expresses through a modern symptom. Because that interplay is always going to happen. There is no end of history. Culture is always going to be there for the untroubled mind to grab onto to begin to shape the expression of the internal anxiety or disability. So we can't get around it. We need to understand it. And I do hope that there is we've been on a biomedical tear for the last, two decades, and we have tremendous advances. But biomedicine is not the end of the story in terms of mental health. Culture is always going to be a factor, much more than it is with a medical illness like a cancer or a polio. culture is always going to be in there, even if that cultural story happens to be the biomedical narrative itself.
Join our conversation with Ethan Waters for the remainder of the hour, 1-866-780-9100, or email us theexchange at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to our first caller, Auriella, is it, from Nevada, Iowa?
Yes. I have bipolar disorder, and while I can certainly tell the difference between being on medication and not being on medication, what helped me cope most with bipolar disorder is a treatment modality called dialectical behavioral therapy, which is explicitly based on, it's, you know, a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and Zen Buddhist thought. So I, you know, I find some irony here in exporting, you know, American views of mental illness when we are importing you know, Eastern views of how to deal with the craziness in our heads and in our lives.
Interesting. Let's get a reaction from Ethan Waters.
I do think that's a very interesting story, and perhaps it's the hopeful aspect of the book that I was mentioning before, which is that if we understand and keep our ear to the ground for how other cultures shape mental illness and heal from them, we have a great deal to learn. I mean, we really do. This is there is not one human psychology. I think Americans tend to be a little bit self-focused, and we have this idea that we think is sort of democratic, that everyone's the same around the world. And mm-hmm. I think when we say that, we often mean everyone's like us, and we assume that's sort of a nice thing to think. And when it comes to psychology and culture, everyone is not like us. And as I said before, you can't stop globalization, but we can certainly, you know, intervene in the rest of the world or interact with the rest of the world in a way in which we can identify you know, healing modalities and ways of thinking about the mind that might be valuable to import.
1-866-780-9100 to speak with Ethan Waters, Crazy Like Us, his latest book, Peter in Waterloo. Hi, good afternoon. Peter, you're on the air. Are you still there?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
You clicked out for a second.
Go ahead. We're hearing you fine.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to thank Mr. Waters for some excellent journalism. We need more journalists to do the work he's doing. I'm a clinical social worker. I teach a course in the DSM-IV, and I teach it because master's level students studying to be therapists need to have this second language, so to speak, in order to deal with the system, to get paid, to have a common language across disciplines. But I teach it from a critical perspective because it's so hypnotizing, and they can get so seduced by slapping a bunch of symptoms and seeing it fit, they think they've done something. So I appreciate his work that we've got to get beyond categorizing people with these labels. Having said that, I realize, you know, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are chemical imbalances, and they need medication appropriately titrated by a psychiatrist who is not running people through the office in 10 minutes. So his approach, looking at this as a culturally constructed, I think really goes a long way, and I just really appreciate it. I would like him to comment, if he could. I know the DSM-IV researchers
Our listeners know DSM-IV is the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, the latest edition of it, for those who are not in the lingo. Go ahead, please.
Right, and it gets thicker and thicker every time they do an update. They're constructing more and more disorders each time. If the author could please comment if he's aware, the DSM, in the introduction to the book, there's a lot of language that seems very empirical. But my understanding is there's a little line in the introduction that says, we're really not sure what a disorder actually is empirically.
Okay, let's get a reaction to that. Peter from Waterloo, thank you very much. You do address the DSM-IV in your book as well.
That's very right. And that is, when you look into the debate, and if you get any glimpse, you know, into the debates behind these illnesses and how they're shaped, you know, there is some science behind it, but there's a lot of, like, simply, you know, groups agreeing that certain symptoms should be clustered in some way. And that my favorite sort of, you know, example to prove that is on the, you know, they're shaping the DSM-5 now, which is going to come out in a couple of years. And then in the middle of those debates about how to change these disorders and rethink about and which disorders to add and which to take away. And on the APA website, there is a make a suggestion. You can go on there, and as just a regular individual, you can make a suggestion for mental illness that you think should be considered for the DSM-5. And I think that just speaks to the fact that these are culturally shaped notions. They are biomedical as well. I am not against psychiatry or against the biomedical notion of psychiatry. My wife is a psychiatrist. She uses drugs to treat people. I think there's a tremendous amount to learn down the road on that. However, I also know from looking across history and looking across cultures that these illnesses do change depending on how you think about them. Mm-hmm. And the mental health profession itself is at the lead for telling us how to think about them. And we need to understand that interaction.
Maybe another quick example you could relate to us from your book, that of the a case of anorexia in Hong Kong, how teenagers began suffering from anorexia after Western experts started raising awareness of this disorder.
Yes, that's right. So in early 90s, there was a particular style of anorexia in Hong Kong, a very rare disorder that didn't look much like the American disorder. It didn't have fat phobia or the body dysmorphic disorder. But there were a few women, like literally a handful of women in the 80s in Hong Kong suffering from anorexia. Then one of those women died in a very dramatic way on a downtown street, just passed out and died, and it caught the media's attention. And the media was charged with, of course, explaining what had happened to this woman. What was this disease? What did it mean? And they went to Western experts to get that information. They went to the diagnostic manuals to say what this disorder was and to the Western experts to say who was at risk, what it meant, and what should be done about it. And suddenly, after that moment in time, after all that information washed over Hong Kong through newspapers and TV reports and so forth, you saw a rise of the actual disorder. So the fear is that the very notion of anorexia can go across cultures. And this was a very insecure time in Hong Kong's history. This was after Tiananmen Square and before the handover of the sovereignty from the British to the Chinese. Lots of people leaving the province, lots of insecurity in the air, and suddenly in the paper there was a new disorder to worry about. And the fear is that when that happens, that the unconscious minds of those women identified as being at risk can suddenly begin to gravitate towards restrictive eating as a way of expressing internal anxiety.
So what is the solution here? What do you see in the future as a good mix of culture and biomedical understanding and mental illness?
That's a very good question. I think my hope is at the very beginning to take the baby step towards any sort of solution is to understand this dynamic, to understand it goes on. And I think there's all sorts of things that you might do once you understood how these things interplay. I think people, journalists like yourself and myself, can begin to think about these things as well, because I think oftentimes we are the conduit to this knowledge. We love the new disorder. We love that, you know, women are, you know, high school kids are now cutting themselves. Feature story, right? This is a great, you know, we run towards these things without an understanding that by publicizing in certain ways that we have the potential of giving the new disorder or the new expression of mental illness a sort of cultural legs. So I think journalists can think harder about this. I think perhaps medical professionals, when they pick up the phone from the journalist, you know, they can begin to understand this interaction, that when they're talking to a journalist or when they're talking in a public forum, that they are, in fact, helping, you know, moving these sort of cultural currents along that keep people in the know of what the next disorder is. So I think the first step is understanding it, and then the next step is trying to figure out how to keep these cultural narratives sort of in check a little bit, I suppose.
We have just over a minute left. I want to try to squeeze in one more caller, several callers waiting. Let's go to Daryl in Waterloo. Daryl, very quickly, what did you have to add?
I lived in Japan for 6 years. My wife is Japanese, and in a conversation we had last night about regret being the things that, not that we do, but we don't do, we discovered that all of her regrets in life were before she finished high school, and mine were mostly after college. And we discovered that, you know, in Japan, hope is not really something they have. It's you set a path for your life very early, and then you're expected to stay on that path. And it's, you know, of course, as Americans, our life really starts at 18. We make huge, you know, career changes, geographical changes,
mm-hmm.
and it was a cultural thing. Her brother now has depression, and he's coming out with all the things he'd like to do in life that he never got to do.
And quickly, another point, a question?
It's interesting that it's coming up now with the drug companies. My firstborn was there. Our firstborn was there in Japan. Socialized healthcare, different than our system. Doctors do get money if they prescribe drugs.
Okay, very good. We'll
Daryl,
thank you for joining us from Waterloo. The final word to you. We have about a minute or so. Ethan Waters, react to that comment and close our show, please.
Oh, I think it's fast. And once you get into to look at these cultural differences, once you embrace them and look at them a little bit, the real joy is that you get to see a little bit of yourself. So it's impossible, I think, within a given culture, if you're only within a given culture, to see how those cultural currents shape your understanding of yourself and your understanding of your mind. You begin to look across history and across cultures. Suddenly you get a better sense of, you know, what is universally human and what is the cultural story that you tell yourself about being human and how that cultural story might play out. And that's certainly my hope for the readers of the book.
Thank you very much, Ethan Waters, for joining us live from San Francisco. Crazy Like Us, his new book, The Globalization of the American Psyche, published by Free Press. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Our producer assistants today, David Henderson and Christoph Mai. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.